Welcome to the NASDAQ Entrepreneurial Center's podcast. In this recording, join Hemant Taneja, Managing Director of General Catalyst, and Kevin Maney for a discussion on their book, Unscaled, How AI and a New Generation of Upstarts Are Creating the Economy of the Future. Here they are. Let's start it off. Hemant, you're Managing Director over at General Catalyst, and you've been investing for over 15 years. So what does unscaled mean to you?
Yeah. Pardon the monologue for a couple of minutes. So if you think about the last century, we've had this massive obsession with scale, right? We've gone and scaled our plants, bigger and bigger power plants to give electricity everywhere. We've scaled our health systems. We've scaled our education. We've scaled our government, corporation, everything. And it's been because we want to provide these basic level of important services in society to everybody. Well, if you look at what that scaling has led to, and you go through each one of these systems, our financial system effectively failed in 2008. Our healthcare system is practically bankrupt. No one can afford it, and it's not a high-quality service to begin with. Education is not preparing kids for the 21st century. Government, clearly broken today. Everything is sort of in a tough spot. And meanwhile, what a lot of you are doing is you're using data and AI and rebuilding every pillar of society today. And that movement is what I call unscaling. And we'll talk more about that as to what that means.
Kevin, you've been writing about tech for over 20 years, over two decades. So what brought your guys' past together to help work on this book?
Well, we had never met, amazingly, actually, considering same circles for so long.
Considering we're old.
Right, we're old. Yeah. And yeah, someone introduced us, and it was soon after Hemant had published a piece in Harvard Business Review. Was that 2013, describing this unscaling idea. And so we met in New York. I live in New York. He lives out here. We had a cocktail, just kind of talking about that idea. Now, as a technology journalist and columnist and author, I hear a lot of ideas. I hear a lot of big thinking, you know, thoughts and all of that. And something struck me as fundamentally interesting about framing things this way. And we just kept talking about it over a number of years, actually. And I would do some, you know, pieces here and there for different publications. And, you know, and eventually the conversation sort of kept going to the point where he said at one point, we should do a book about this. And I thought he was kidding, except that I find out he doesn't kid about things. So we ended up doing a book. I think I've done a lot about the history of technology, and there was an aspect of this conversation that really struck me. And it goes back, if you think about what happened at the beginning of the 20th century, in that period from like the late 1800s to the early 1910 timeframe, there was an unbelievable burst of technology that was invented around that time. That's when we, you know, invented the car, the airplane, electrified the world, invented the telephone, telegraph, all of those things. So that literally like life in 1890 was completely different from life in 1920. And all of those technologies, and this is a conversation we kept having, which I just thought was, you know, we really started making this really sort of rich and interesting. All of those technologies, if you think about it, were what allowed us to build highly scaled businesses and institutions, because you needed communication and transportation and, you know, all those different kinds of things. So they set the stage for this whole emergence of economies of scale being the be-all and end-all, making mass production, mass markets, make the most of the same thing for the most people was a way to make a lot of money. And what Hema pointed out was what's happening in this particular time frame. We're probably about 10 years into another 30-year stretch that's much like that period of time back then, where we've invented, started with the, you know, the iPhone and cloud and mobile technology and social media and all of these things being invented. And now we're accelerating it with AI and coming next around the corner, things like blockchain or 3D printing. So we're creating this new fundamental set of technologies that create an entirely different sort of platform for industries and businesses, so that instead of fueling scaling up, it's actually fueling an ability for every company to make things that are targeted at a small niche of consumers or actually individual people and do it profitably. And so those unscaled companies can now take chunks out of those old scaled companies that can't move as fast. And that's, as we're saying, we're probably 10 years into this 30-year cycle of inventing these all these amazing technologies that are literally going to change the world as much as that original verse did 100 years ago.
And I love how this book brings together both of your guys' perspectives, right? I mean, when talking about unscaling, though, are you suggesting that people don't scale?
No, it's not that. It's, I think on the supply side, take the mindset in the healthcare system, for example. We have 30 million people that unfortunately have diabetes in our country, and that number is increasing. In the traditional scaled healthcare system, the protocol for giving them optimal care is go see your PCP 3 to 4 times a year and make sure your blood glucose levels sort of are in generally a good spot. Well, the reality is if you're good enough to go see your PCP, those 4 times, those 4 moments, you're probably okay. And all the progression of this disease happens in between those 4 moments. And so that's clearly a system that's designed to figure out how to get these 30 million people through a suboptimal way of care. And about 5 years ago, we decided, well, how do we take these principles of unscaling and go give those 30 million diabetics the care that they need? So from first principles, we designed a connected glucometer. We give it out to them. There's strips in the Lancet. Nothing fancy. These are technologies that have been around. Show up at their door because we know how many they're using. And every time they're running out of supplies, we send them to them. All they have to do is check their blood glucose. That data goes into the cloud. Is monitored by machine learning. If they're starting to deviate from healthy levels of blood glucose, the system will remind them to go around the block and take a walk or drink a glass of water or drink a glass of orange juice to get back to some level of normalcy. And if it's really deviating, we'll call them. A diabetes counselor will call them and say, hey, you need to do XYZ to get better. So just contrast this way of real-time monitoring those 30 million people and understanding exactly what's going on in their bodies from the traditional scale system, which was come see the overloaded healthcare professionals 4 times a year, and we'll somehow make sure you're going to be okay. That system costs us $300 billion a year. When we do a teardown of, well, what could this new way of delivering chronic care management provide, we think we can save over $100 billion to the healthcare system. Not just one company, but sort of a series of companies that are tackling that problem. And that's the whole point, which is get away from this mindset of here's a basic level of service and mass produce it for everybody to what is it that an individual or groups of individuals with the same needs and have products that can iterate towards being optimal for them. So start unscaling these markets. Don't think of them as being all things to all people. So it's a core philosophy of how companies, winning companies are getting built today. And there's patterns of this across verticals.
And to address your question of does that mean you don't scale? I think one company that shows how that works is Netflix. We often talked about, Netflix is a great example of an unscaled company in the sense that it took apart what television networks and HBOs of the world that served a giant mass market used to do. And instead it uses all this data to understand small audiences and create programs that are targeted exact right at those. So right now Netflix is actually spending more money and giving more television programs to go ahead than any entity that ever existed. Any television network, any movie studio, it's now the biggest producer of television shows on the planet. But all of those shows are geared towards a niche audience because they know who wants those shows and what they'll be like. So it's actually a giant scaled company now, but it's essentially an unscaled approach to what it's doing. Instead of treating the audience as a mass market, it's treating the audience as an audience of individuals.
Same in banking. You know, we have our banking system today that essentially monetizes the affluent by investing their money and charges lots of fees to folks that can't afford banking and don't really have any savings, right? Through overdrafts and checking fees and things like that. It's this scaled system that is trying to be all things to all people and doesn't really serve the needs of most of those demographics. So you're seeing all these modern financial services companies popping up that are saying, hey, folks that need to learn how to save, we'll use AI and give them a service that can actually save for them. Or the folks that actually need to learn how to invest better or need to be able to invest better, we'll do it for them. And, you know, that's an example would be like Wealthfront or Betterment. So you're seeing this sort of unbundling of these services off of the scaled banking system. Some of this is obvious because we live in Silicon Valley, but the reality is that this is the pattern that's eviscerating the large companies of the last century, one by one, because we're fundamentally creating better consumer experiences for smaller and smaller populations of customers.
I love that. Yeah, from mass production to mass customization. And you bring up machine learning and artificial intelligence, and there's so much buzz around that. And you bring it up in the book that when thinking about building a new business or a startup or an existing startup or even an existing corporate enterprise, that how there's so much out there, right? Like that you can rent, right? Rentable services like AWS, for instance. So can you talk about like the, what's driving the unscaled wave there? I mean, yeah. How people can become more efficient and not have to build the $100 million factory anymore.
Yeah, so when I got in the venture business 15 years ago, the kinds of companies we'd be investing in is, hey, let's go build software that makes physicians more efficient, or software that insurance adjusters can use in the field, or software that teachers can use, or accountants can use, right? And there's large companies that have been created in enterprise software that went and built these workflows. If you said to me 15 years ago, as an entrepreneur, I want to build a company that's going to create the new insurance company or the new healthcare company that actually delivers healthcare service, I would say, not interested. Those companies have economies of scale, and you can't really compete. Today, fast forward a decade, and if you look at the last 5 or 6 years, we salivated those companies. We love it when somebody's coming and saying, we want to reimagine healthcare for education for K-12, or we want to reimagine healthcare for the population that has problem X, right? We salivated those because those are massive ideas. There's really big companies getting built. We want to reimagine transportation. Look at the big companies of this generation. That's what they're all doing. And the reason that can happen is because all the advantages that scale gave to the incumbents, that was access to customers, access to production in factories, access to distribution, capital, every one of those is a rentable utility today, right? You can rent computing on Amazon. You can rent manufacturing at Flextronics. You can rent access to consumers and build a brand on Facebook and Twitter, every one of those. So all of a sudden, this notion that you can't compete as a small company actually got reversed. You get to win as a small company because most of the complexity of building a business and running a scale operation, you can just rent from the ecosystem, and you can obsess over your customer and the feedback loop to keep iterating your product for those customers. And that is a winning formula, isn't it? If you can get to everybody and you can just give them a fundamentally better product, you're going to win. That core advantage is what I called economies of unscale. And that core advantage is why what was insurmountable before, taking on these incumbents, is actually the norm. And it's sort of the mission of this generation of entrepreneurs.
Well, and then the piece of the dynamic that happens is the company that owns the scale ends up being at a disadvantage. We often talked about Procter & Gamble. And so think about Dollar Shave. And here is some little company going up against a giant consumer products company. But they could, you know, use social media to essentially reach customers for free. They could rent manufacturing capabilities. They could rent the computing rent all this stuff and basically focus just on this quirky little product for this quirky little audience and take a chunk out of the razor and shaving business. But Gillette or Procter & Gamble, whoever's in the shaving business, owns all of these plants and all these fixed costs and everything, and somebody starts taking a little bit of their business away, they can't respond to that. They're stuck with the scale that they owned and built rather than, you know, being able to just, you know, rent it and quickly move and do something differently. So that's happening just over and over and over again.
Yeah. So do you think there'll be a hyper niche market for startups out there? Like there will be a startup for the Hemants of the world, right? I mean, like, where do you think this unscaling, how custom do you think it will get based on? Because, I mean, there's so much information out there on everybody. You mentioned Facebook and Twitter, right? I mean, somebody could probably predict what kind of lunch I'm going to have tomorrow, right? Like, where do you think that's going?
So to me, I often describe this as the golden age of innovation and venture capital, because this whole notion that an idea has to be at scale to take on kind of doesn't matter anymore. Because what used to be subscale, so if there's 10 people in the world that can benefit from your product and you really want to work on that problem, you can probably do that profitably and earn a living. And maybe there's 10 people like that, maybe there's one, and maybe there's 100,000. In the case of Facebook, there were billions, right? So you sort of don't have to think about that when you're starting. You're very much focused on, I've got a product idea, I've got a customer I want to service, I can get to everybody that's like-minded kind of a customer because of the channels available, and the business will have its own ceiling. right? And so what you'll see is an ecosystem of businesses proliferate on these platforms. And some ought to be large, and some should just have a natural ceiling. And then the economics take over, and people will rebundle these businesses and create new brands and all that. But I think there's a massive secular shift where we're walking away from that previous generation of how businesses got built and scaled to this current mindset.
Yeah, and you mentioned Procter & Gamble in the book, and you just mentioned Procter & Gamble. So is there any hope for the larger organizations who are already mass producing things?
Well, yes, actually, if they approach this in a smart and wise way. And so we bring up Procter & Gamble. Now, Procter & Gamble has a program called Connect and Develop. And it doesn't seem like it's flourishing, but the idea behind Connect and Develop seems to be right, that a corporation like Procter & Gamble could actually turn itself into a rentable platform. And so the basic idea of Connect and Develop is that an entrepreneur can come to Procter & Gamble and say, I have this brilliant idea for a new baby powder that, you know, suited for this particular small audience, and could go and rent P&G's manufacturing, marketing, you know, distribution system to just make this product and get it out to, you know, to the right audience. Now, not many companies are thinking, corporations are thinking that way, it doesn't seem yet. Some are playing with this on the edge. General Electric has been another one, but that is one opportunity for them, is to think in terms of upscaling and actually turn themselves into these rentable platforms.
Yeah, so the bottom line is these big companies are terrible at being customer-facing, right? I mean, they're so atrophied with dealing with internal issues or regulatory issues that they often don't think as much about the customer. So in every one of these places where, in industries where these ecosystem of new startups are emerging, the incumbents that choose to be the enabler of the ecosystem versus competing with it are the ones that are going to survive. So if you're a bank, you can say, I've got my regulatory and compliance assets, and I will open those up into APIs so the Betterments and the Wealthfronts and the Digits, you know, and the Acorns can all proliferate on top of me, and you'll actually end up being the banking cloud platform, because you don't need 1,000 banks in this country. No one goes to these retail outlets anymore, right? But the one or two that make that leap will become the dominant sort of cloud platforms in banking. Same thing in healthcare. The prevailing view is that for primary care, it should just be virtual. I should just be able to get telecare. Well, if it's virtual, then this notion that your customers are around your campus doesn't make any sense anymore. So is Stanford going to be the first one that says we're going virtual and we're going to make our services available everywhere through an online platform, or is it going to be the Harvard Medical System or what? So the ones that take that leap will have that opportunity to be the cloud health platform. And I think you can take that paradigm across every industry, and leaders of these large companies are figuring out how they're going to be relevant going forward. These are the choices that are in front of them. Do they become comfortable that they want to enable these ecosystems to flourish on top, ecosystems of companies that you all are building, or are they going to try to compete? Because they can't compete. They won't be able to compete because they just won't have the customer experiences that are winning.
Let me ask you about that. Is when entrepreneurs come to you to pitch to you, what are you listening for that tells you that, hey, this is a potential unscaled company that can really reinvent it?
The empathy for the customer. What specifically is it they understand about their customer that they'll be able to win with? Mm-hmm. It's very much the focus.
Yeah, knowing your customer is something that we tell here at the center all the time, right? Black box innovation never works. Whenever you speak to a founder, like Kevin was alluding to, and they haven't gone and talked to enough customers, what advice do you give them when they need to go do a little bit more research? I mean, like, in order to unscale, you need to talk to A, B, and C.
I think my first reaction is I move on to the next place to spend time. But I think the advice I would give is that I do think you have to understand exactly who you're solving the problem for. And the one caution I have is these ideas are so large that you do have to think differently about how to build companies in these markets. So when you say, I want to build a chronic care platform for diabetes, or I want to help the 50% of this population in this country that doesn't know how to financially manage and save, well, you can't think about what is the thing that I'm going to build that's going to have market dominance and scale really, really fast, because you shouldn't think that way. You really need to think about who's the specific type of end user I care about and how can I fundamentally change your life? Because if you do, you will grow at extraordinary rates and you'll build a great company. You don't need to worry about how do I get greater than 50% market share, because chances are greater than 50% market share would be like the top 5 company in the world, meaning these markets are too large. So I think the cadence for just deeply understanding what slice Do you want to unscale off the traditional market to build for and be obsessed with that slice of customers? That's what I look for. That's the advice I would give.
And Kevin, I mean, you do journalism, so you're trying to get to the unwritten answers to all the questions, right? So what are your advice to our community founders, either here or online, that how do you get to the root of what somebody actually needs and whether or not that you're solving a problem that's meaningful to them?
Well, that is, I mean, and actually going back to previous things I've done, I mean, as he hit on, I think the core question that is so hard for a lot of people to answer is, what problem are you really solving and for who? And unbelievably, so many companies can't answer that question in any sort of real English. You know, they'll throw a bunch of acronyms or jargon at you and can't really answer that question. So that's, I mean, as a journalist who's listening for new ideas, I mean, that's the core of what I would be listening for.
Totally. And I love in the book, you cover industries that you think AI and the generation of us upstarts are really, really going to make a difference. And there's so much information out there on this. Energy, you talk about healthcare a little bit. What do you think is really trending right now? And where do you think people aren't really putting their eyes on the target as far as where to be focusing next?
So first of all, as Kevin was saying, I really do think, just imagine or go back and think about what life was like 10 years ago. And how different it is today, and forward project another 20 years where you now have your attention with, you know, AR and VR, and you've got biological tools like CRISPR that are going to exist, and all these new technologies that are getting built today. Life's going to be very different between 10 years ago when we started organizing ourselves, content, community, and commerce online, to where we're headed sort of in the next two decades. So I think, first of all, the change is quite profound across the board. Where am I putting dollars? Where do I think there's significant opportunity in the next decade that hasn't been cracked yet? Healthcare is absolutely one. And I think it's necessitated because it is just unaffordable for all of us. For us, for businesses, everybody's just in a lot of hurt. And I think the other is finance. Banking is changing significantly. I think the banking experience isn't great. And you're seeing tremendous innovation happening. So Europe is ahead on the regulatory front to open up its access to data in the financial services sector. And you're seeing all kinds of challenger banks emerge there much faster. And to me, that's a precursor to what's going to happen here as well. And those are, when you think about it, very large markets. Other than that, insurance, we have a lot of great companies in the insurance sector. I mean, it really is across the board. I think this is a secular shift we're all taking part in.
Well, that's what's fun right now. And from my point of view as someone who gets to like learn about things and write about them, is that there's nothing off the table now. Every single industry, business sector that you never would have thought of. And, you know, as I'm just saying that, I'm thinking like, well, there's an incredible burst in investment right now in farm technology. And if you think about it, I was talking to somebody about this the other day. If you were to invent the farm today, the idea of putting it on a giant plot of land under the sun outside would not be the way you would invent a farm. Because if you put a farm outside and it's, you know, subject to weather variations and to pests and, you know, and all these kinds of things, and because it has to be on a giant amount of acreage, it's way far away from any of its customers. So there's now a whole spurt of, you know, unscaled farms that are starting to happen, these indoor farms that are built in old industrial buildings inside inner cities where they can be like hundreds of times more productive than an outdoor farm. There's no bugs, so there's no pesticides. Sunlight is LED lights that can be, you know, controlled down to, you know, the microsecond of how much they're getting and not getting. It's all driven by AI and robotics and all these new technologies. And this is how we're going to basically feed the next 2.5 billion people who get born in the next 20 years.
Don't be surprised if all your malls go out of business and become indoor farms. And
become farms, exactly.
It could happen. You're going to grow lettuce there.
So every sector, even the ones you see most unlikely to be reinvented, are in the process of being reinvented. And it's because of this burst of technologies that are making all of these things possible. And by the way, and the distance thing, now you've got farms that are actually close to the customers so that when you get a tomato, it doesn't taste like a baseball.
So let's get down to a little bit of a tactical move. And I think I'd love to hear from both your perspectives on this. So when unscaling, you're telling us and the reader to really focus on who the customer is, right? What the problem is, and to use services like renting AWS instead of building them. But how do you really see startups that are already in existing businesses really utilizing this unscaling concept? And how do you think them thinking of their business from a high level to apply it?
I'm pretty sure every business that we're all involved in here in this room is being built on the principles of unscaling because we're in Silicon Valley. That's just how we all think, right? So to me, that part of it is mainstream here. The Fortune 1000 is an existential threat for them if they don't embrace this mindset. But for us, this is an enabling power for us. I think the bigger question for me and for us to think about is, well, we've had this core philosophy that we should move fast and break things and iterate and be hackers, right, for the last 7 or 8 years and last decade. And that was okay when we're building movies or games or, you know, chat rooms. It's not okay when you're starting to think about somebody's health or, you know, financial management or how they're going to learn and prepare themselves for the next, for their career. And so that level of responsibility is fundamentally at odds with this core mindset of being a hacker, I think. I'm not saying don't be iterative, but I'm just saying be a lot more empathetic because the stakes are really, really high when we start to think about the kinds of companies we are building now. So to me, it's about cadence. It's about what is your MVP? Like the things I think about sort of in boardrooms or with founders is what does it mean to be a minimum viable product? It shouldn't just mean, well, we can hook them and they engage with you. You know, like the diabetes app shouldn't say, ah, I create a hack where they come back to my app all the time and now I've got MVP. It should be about keeping them healthier, right? The education app shouldn't be exactly about sort of getting my attention. It should be about the person is fundamentally learning better. The person is fundamentally saving better or investing better. And so that makes it harder. Because that means the products need to be richer, deeper, more empathetic, and you're going to be making trade-offs of, you know, what might look good in the short term for your business. If it's not aligned with what's good long-term for society, that you're going to have to think about that. And you're going to say, do I really want to grow 3, 4, 5x a year, or is it okay to grow 50% a year but do it right by the customers in the way we're building products? I think that's where the rubber meets the road. Those are the trade-offs that need to be made. Am I going to have regard for regulation, or am I going to say, let me get big and then I'll deal with regulation when I have scale because I'm under the radar right now? I'm going to think about it. That's the choices that are in front of us as we take on these important sectors. And that's what I'd like all of you to think about, you know, as you're, you know, building your companies.
And what we've seen is those impacts can happen so fast now. And one of the conversations we had writing the book a number of times was, again, using history to as a guide. If you could go back to, you know, 1910 and addressed the automobile industry and knew what the impact of the automobile was going to be 100 years out, how it was going to, you know, change cities and, you know, and destroy the atmosphere and, you know, and then do all these things that the automobile ended up doing, would you tell the automobile industry to do some things differently, to think about that thing that it was inventing in a different way? Now you couldn't because it was things happened so slowly. There weren't the feedback loops that we have today. But now with all these fast feedback loops and AI and, you know, and the ability to understand what's going on, we're asking that, you know, you have those conversations now rather than, you know, after they're too late and after, you know, the EU government comes after you or something like that happens.
Yeah. Look, those long feedback loops cause all kinds of problems. The cereal industry caused diabetes, right? Because we had this fascination with corn and that we made this mass production of food. And that's where a lot of the chronic conditions around these metabolic issues have emerged from. You know, you gave the example of climate change with the internal combustion engine. I mean, there's examples like that all over the place in these different industries. The good news with AI, you can actually measure real time what's happening. In fact, the technology has already been intentionally and unintentionally misused, right? I mean, think about elections or you think about the biases that have emerged that, you know, companies weren't even thinking about that ended up being in the products. Like, so how do we design algorithmic canaries into our products so that we're seeing where these products are starting to deviate from what's good for society, measure that and iterate, right? I think that's there's a framework we often talk about around sort of transparency, accountability, and explainability of AI. Like, how do we do that from the beginning, and how we take advantage of these technologies? How do we make sure we're only going to use them where we can actually measure the influence in society, as opposed to be like, oh, let's get it out there. It's helping us grow fast, and we don't really care about what biases it might be taking advantage of and how it might be good or bad for society. Let's not think that way. So these are the choices in front of us as we start to use these technologies.
And that touches two really, really big themes of the book, which I love and I really resonate with, is the responsible innovation and also algorithmic accountability, because there's so much information about all of us and there's so much data out there that really, I mean, you're suggesting, and I really appreciate that, that the founders should be thinking really early on when building what they're going to do with the information. In the book, you discuss the fear almost of what if it all comes true, right? Like, yeah. what if VR yeah. is yeah. the world that we're living in, right? You guys are all sitting in here in person, but what if we're in VR and a VR classroom, and what if there are no jobs thanks to robots and AI? I mean, how much of that is a reality, and how much of it can we be optimistic about, I guess?
So it's like Silicon Valley and centers like Silicon Valley are creating this new puzzle around what life's going to be like. And we do have to think about how all these pieces fit together. So one example I often use is, you know, somewhere on 101, there's probably, you know, a bunch of startups that are doing self-driving trucks. Great economic case. You can absolutely build a big company. There's a bunch of work being done around longevity so we can all live longer and conquer disease in these ways. And then there's experiments going on around basic income. Because we've generally sort of embraced the idea that, well, jobs aren't going to be around, and how are people going to feed themselves? Well, what if all of that came true? Can you just think about the scenario we've created for ourselves? It's you're going to go to 4 million people in this country that are truck drivers and say, I've got good news and bad news. Good news, you're going to live 30 years longer. Bad news, no job for you. And by the way, we're also going to take away any ounce of self-esteem because we're going to put you on a stipend for survival. That's a terrible way to live. So while each of those companies could say we've got a phenomenal mission that we're trying to build a business around or a nonprofit around, but when you sort of put these things together, like, does that really make sense in terms of the world we're trying to create? And that, it's all at our fingertips. We're creating all this stuff, and I think that comes with great responsibility. So we do have to think about that as we put these things together, because technology is fundamentally neutral. It's up to us how we, you know, harness it.
And to put a big exclamation point on that is to put on my historian hat for a second. Think back to what I was talking about earlier about that burst of technology from roughly 1890 to 1910. Well, what happened right after 1910? We ended up with World War I, a Great Depression, and World War II. So these bursts of technology can drive enormous social and geopolitical change and disruption. And if they're not handled wisely, they lead to unbelievable disaster. And so if any of you are sort of sitting out there thinking to what he's saying about responsible innovation and thinking, well, that sort of gets in the way of my developing my business. Well, how good is your business going to be if there's another world war? Not very good. So maybe it's actually good business to think that way.
So Hemant, I love that you are now focusing on more responsible businesses, but what currently are you at GC looking at as far as an investment thesis perspective, and what are you really, really interested in? What's hot right now?
Well, it's a pretty big platform, so we look at pretty much everything. We're looking at, so in the healthcare space, the problem I'm quite interested in is mental health. It's obviously a serious epidemic, and kind of means all things to all people. There's different pieces to that problem, but how do we really take a shot at that from first principles? I think that's, we have a pretty significant effort trying to understand that problem. You know, we have companies in insurance that's done really well for us. We, as I mentioned, banking and financial services is quite interesting. Brands, you know, you were mentioning Procter & Gamble. Every one of the sub-brands that P&G and Unilever and others have is an opportunity to go build a company because, you know, they have the old way of going and building resonance with customers, and you can build fundamentally better products and build better relationship with the customers today. So that's being chipped away at, and we've got lots of great companies growing, and we're always looking for new brands. You know, AR, VR, we're waiting for the moment. because the right device and form factor hasn't really happened yet. Again, a technology you have to be very careful about, because the thing I worry about with AR, VR is it takes away a shared sense of reality for all of us. You know, those of you that saw Ready Player One, sort of it's an interesting portrayal of that issue that can emerge. I'm very interested in what's happening in pharma, going from trying to create these blockbuster drugs that are really expensive and only work at a small percentage of time, because again, those drugs are being all things to all people, kind of taking the Netflix model and applying to drugs and applying it to subpopulations and using AI and machine learning to reduce the cost of building those drugs. I think that's a massive opportunity. We'll have drugs with better efficacy that are much more long tail and relevant for our own metabolics with pharmacogenomics. I think that's an interesting area. I could keep going, but it's really broad. It's not like the firm's focused on one specific area. We have 12 partners, and it's all over the place. We do think about crypto, which I'm sure a lot of you think about, and crypto is a response from this community to undo sort of this platform creation, essentially, right? Where we're like, oh, this technology is going to get misused with these sort of large platforms, and how do we decentralize everything? So the spirit of crypto is and blockchain is quite pure. I think what's driving it today is speculation, but in the long run, I do think it's an interesting way to reconfigure our technologies yet again for to take advantage of unscaling. We talk about that in the book a little bit.
So. And Kevin, I mean, you're on the ground, you're hearing from new technologies, you're hearing from startups all over the U.S. all the time. Where do you see the unwritten, I guess, focus area? I mean, you mentioned blockchain and crypto, right? There's no news there. But what do you see as like the next minor wave in AI, these upstarts focus that unscale? I mean, who can apply the unscaled model that isn't?
Well, I'm going to go back to what I said earlier about the what problem are you solving question. When I hear from companies that say, I've got a cool new blockchain company, I'm automatically not interested, because it's like saying in 1994, I'm building an internet company. Well, that doesn't tell me anything. It's not actually solving anybody's problem or addressing a particular market. So if somebody comes to me and says, I'm going to change the way X happens in a better way, oh, and by the way, I'm going to use this and this technology to do it, then I'm interested. So, I mean, and if, like the whole farming thing is a good example of like, I don't want to, if somebody comes to me and says, I'm building a blockchain farm, like that doesn't make any sense to me. But if somebody comes and, and describes how I can change the way food, gets created and delivered to people in an inner city neighborhood in a way that's fundamentally better for everybody, including the environment, then I go, oh, okay. How do you do that? Now we have a conversation about technology.
Yeah. And talking about solving problems, I mean, you talk about education in the book, and that's like a big area of improvement. I think we can all agree. That, so what do you really see AI helping with as far as with the education industry? And I mean, just industry, hardly. But how do you think AI could help education?
So, if you think about learning, there was this whole notion of a master-apprentice relationship, right? And you would go pick an area that you're interested in, you'd go watch somebody who's a master at that and learn from that. And probably venture capital is the last business where there's some of that still remaining. Generally, we don't train that way. Somehow, as we were scaling the education system, it went from that master-apprentice relationship to it's 8 o'clock in the morning on a Wednesday, and you're 12 years old, so this is your math hour, and you're going to factor polynomials. And that is the way we train you to go prepare yourself for the 21st century, right? It's utterly broken. So I think how do we inject this sort of mastery-based system using AI so that you're learning at your own pace, you're learning when it's your sort of interest, and you're pursuing your own interest and learning in the way that you like to learn, and the software is sort of adapting to that and learning from that and helping you get there. That's a very different way to train you for the workforce from what we do today, this Prussian model is highly antiquated. So you're seeing a lot of models of schools emerging that are trying to take a shot at that. We've built one in Mountain View where actually my kids go.
And you work closely with Khan Academy.
With Khan Academy, that's right. And so it's the first floor of Khan Academy. We have 150 kids now, and they learn this sort of self-paced mindset. And they're actually good by independence level as opposed to what they know. I think education, I've always believed, is not a place for venture capital to create great returns. So all my work has been nonprofit in that sector. But I do think we need to massively innovate here if we're going to prepare our kids for this notion that you're going to go from this, learn for 20 years, and then go get stuck in a job for the next 40, to you're constantly learning and working and evolving your interests. That's where we're going, right? You don't stay at one place for too long, and you want to be able to pick up the new interest. So learning how to learn is important, and go change careers all the time. And that's the kind of environment, that fluid environment, that the education system needs to retool to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kevin, any?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly if you think about it, the entire education system, you know, K through 12 plus, you know, in college, is built on the scaled model of things, right? It's built on the factory model of how do you get the most people through a system with the same sort of way of doing things, so it's the least expensive as possible. And actually, not to take anything away from that, for 100 years, that was brilliant. We educated more people and got more people, literacy rates driven down. I mean, it was actually a great solution for the 20th century. But as Khan Academy, for instance, it adopts more and more AI so that every course a child takes is essentially learning how that child learns, and now starting to educate that child, in a very personalized way. That's unscaling education, and you start to take apart that whole scale. There's a new and better way to do it because of the technologies we've invented, and what's going to happen over the next 20, 30, or 50 years or whatever, is we're going to take apart that old scaled education industry and reinvent it in this unscaled way. And, you know, is every university going to disappear? I mean, that's, of course, not what's going to happen. But it's certainly going to change it in a very big way. I can't imagine that the idea of a 50 or 60,000 student public university that tries to be all things to all people is going to do very well 25 or 30 years from now. I think that's probably, a big question mark.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, both of you. And one curious question, just because of the title, and I mean, I'm sure you guys get a lot of interesting inquiries from this, right? How many times have you said, I'm writing unscaled, and you just get like a jaw drop or like a, what are you even thinking? I mean, is it like an immediate, like, I'm picking it up, I know exactly what you're talking about? Like, did you get any slam doors from publishers when you're first talking about this? What are you talking about, unscaling?
But it's a confusing word. So we do get to what does that mean? We actually debated a lot as to how to title the book. But I think this, in the end, we decided to do it this way just to focus on the point that this whole obsession with scale and scaling everything, we're past that. I think scale, I mean, I'd submit, you know, it's kind of run its course. This notion of make bigger and bigger and bigger things, bigger governments, bigger this, bigger that, doesn't serve society well anymore, and we are going into this era. So I think it's supposed to spark the debate. I mean, there was somewhat intentional.
Kevin, any slam doors in your experience with the book?
No, you know, as anybody who's tried to create a company name or name a new category of product or service, there's two ways to do it. One is to do something that's very descriptive, and another is to actually create a word that then you fill with a new description that everybody. So, you know, in a sense, that's kind of what we're trying to do here. It's an intriguing word, and we have to give it meaning.
No, and
that's our job.
From success stories to what's coming onto the future, I think you guys are covering what is coming up, and yes, as far as this mass customization, and that's actually solving problems for customers instead of this build it and they will buy kind of solution. So
yeah, to me, this exercise was about a call to action, and I think it's about responsible innovation and just raising that dialogue. And I do think this effort is serving its purpose and making sure that's being talked about more. That was the goal.
and responsible innovation with the algorithmic accountability, right? I mean, if you have a lot more information about people, you're arguing that should be.
I mean, we're living in a very turbulent time where we're seeing the impacts of how technology, these technologies can be weaponized. And, you know, it's great. There's a silver lining in that. It's actually great that we're seeing that so that we can now build with greater care than the past decade of companies have done.
All right. Well, Kevin, Hemant, thank you so much for coming out and sharing your story with us. Let's give it up real quick for them.